Well, thank you very much for your kind invitation to this conference, which I've enjoyed very much so far today. We've had, I think, some very interesting and very broad and very general papers. My paper is not going to be quite so broad. It's a much narrower topic. But I've chosen it because I want to use this study of the bombing and Barbarossa as an opportunity to say a few perhaps rather challenging things about the nature of about the nature of German and British strategy during the period of Barbarossa. And most of what, or the starting of Barbarossa, most of what I'm going to be talking about today will be focused almost exactly on that period 70 years ago, which this conference is coinciding with. I want to start off by reminding people about the German bombing offensive against Britain between July 1940 and June 1941. It was the first major strategic bombing offensive. But in most accounts of the Second World War, this bombing offensive, which the British called the Blitz, which the Germans called the England-Angriff, this bombing offensive is normally seen as something quite distinct from the Barbarossa campaign that followed it. Indeed, they're normally treated by historians as distinct things. The bombing offensive against Britain is something which is connected with the British War, but the Barbarossa campaign is something connected with the war in the East. Very much the same is true of the British bombing of Germany, which began in May 1940, and it's worth remembering that it starts in May 1940. For almost the next 100 days, RAF aircraft are bombing somewhere in Germany. Starts in May 1940, is escalated in 1941, and moves on to area bombing by 1942. Now, British bombing goes on through this whole period of the German bombing offensive and the period, the opening period of Barbarossa. But this too is always treated as a separate issue, not something connected to the rest of the war. And what I want to try and do this afternoon is just to ask some questions about what connects bombing and Barbarossa together. And to try to counteract, if you like, the tendency to see this as two wars, a war in the West and a war in the East, a war against the Soviet Union on the one hand and a war against Britain and the United States on the other. Well, the first problem, I think, with the German bombing offensive is that historians have hardly ever taken it seriously. The two major studies we have of the German Air Force in this period, one the official history published by the Militärgeschichtliches Forschungsamt, and the other the book on the Luftwaffe by Williamson Murray, both stop their narratives in November or October 1940, and they start their narratives again with June the 22nd, 1941. There's this extraordinary 9 or 10 month gap in which it's as if German strategy came to a temporary halt. And of course, most historians, military historians, when they focus on the German bombing, tend to argue that it was a waste of strategic effort, a real waste of strategic effort, if you were really aiming to invade the Soviet Union with maximum force to achieve a swift victory. But of course, it's important for us to recall that one of the reasons that Hitler gave for the invasion of the Soviet Union was precisely because the Soviet Union was Britain's last potential ally in Europe. And if you could destroy the Soviet Union in a quick campaign, you could then destroy Britain's last hope of continuing the war. That analysis, of course, does put Barbarossa and the bombing into a single strategic picture, as I've been arguing. And it's quite interesting, actually, to look at Winston Churchill's speech, which he makes on the 22nd of June, on about the day Barbarossa starts, the speech in which he pledges his support to anybody who is fighting against Hitler. And he talks in that speech about the deeper motive that lies behind the German invasion of the Soviet Union. And that deeper motive, he says, is to destroy Soviet power, grab Soviet resources, and then turn back again to the task of destroying the British Empire. Churchill, too, I think, like Hitler, saw this as part of a single strategic picture. But I want to argue this afternoon that there are more strategic factors which explain the German bombing offensive between July 1940 and June 1941. The first thing, of course, once Hitler had begun to think about an invasion of the Soviet Union, first of all in July 1940, and then confirmed finally in December 1940, the first thing that the bombing was designed to do, of course, was to persuade Moscow that German plans for the invasion or destruction of Britain were a top priority. And it's quite interesting, if you look at Maisky's memoirs, he was the Soviet ambassador in London, written after the war, he writes that he was convinced and conveyed back to Moscow this conviction that Hitler's priority was really to physically destroy and occupy Britain. And that's what Maisky and others focused on when we looked at German strategy. Now, bombing paused in January and February because of poor weather, but it was renewed with heavy bombing attacks in March, April and May 1941. And all of this, again, was designed partly to persuade Stalin that Hitler's priority really was Britain. Destroying Britain first, and then what might happen? Well, Stalin thought perhaps a campaign in 1942 or 1943. Of course, by March or April 1941, the bombing was also designed to cover the shift, which already started, of German forces eastward, particularly of German air forces eastward. That effort to persuade Stalin and to disguise Hitler's intention was temporarily, of course, almost unhinged by the decision by Rudolf Hess to fly to Scotland on the night of 9th and 10th of May 1941, a move which, of course, threatened Hitler's whole strategy, because it might have persuaded Stalin that a German invasion in the near future was a possibility. It's quite interesting, and I've not been able to find any evidence of this in the German record, so somebody may be able to help me. It's very interesting, that very night after Hess's flight was the second heaviest raid on London, the last and heaviest raid on London. I wonder whether that was done deliberately as a display to Moscow to show yet again how serious Germany was about finishing off Britain. And I think unless you can find some strategic reasons for the offensive, it's hard to understand it, because it was an extremely expensive campaign from the German point of view. Between January and June 1941, the figures show that the German Air Force lost, destroyed or damaged 1,068 bombers and 599 fighters. That's a large number of aircraft to lose in a three-month campaign shortly before you're about to embark on the invasion of the Soviet Union. But it's important because I think there are other strategic reasons too, which are not just connected with trying to persuade Stalin that Britain is Hitler's priority. It's also, I think, a signal to the United States. Now, by this stage, of course, Hitler is increasingly concerned, as we know, about what role the United States will play, whether the United States might even at some point come into the war on Britain's side, or the degree of economic assistance that the United States is giving to Britain. And one of the advantages of the Blitz, of course, is that it would tell the United States, first of all, that it was too risky to send goods and equipment to Britain, which might very quickly fall into German hands. And that's precisely what the army staff argued in the United States right up until the end of 1940. This might be a risk. We send a lot of material there, it might end up being used against us at some point by the Germans. The second thing is that the bombing of Britain made it clear to the American leadership, to Roosevelt, that Britain was close to imminent defeat or invasion, and that this too would make it difficult for Roosevelt to persuade the American public that it was worth the effort of trying to help Britain out of the European crisis. It's quite interesting that in directives to bomber crews in November, December, January 1941, I found regular references to the need to destroy American goods in British ports and warehouses. An assumption, wrong assumption in fact, that America was already supplying very extensive resources to underpin the British war effort. But the main factor, I would argue, in explaining the persistent long-term bombing offensive against Britain, the main factor was the desire to find some way of weakening the British war economy and Britain's military capability. Of course, it was possible that the strategy of naval blockade and bombing might actually force Britain to sue for an armistice. Though it's interesting to note, I think, that Hitler was not at all confident about that throughout the whole period of the Blitz. Didn't actually expect it to bring Britain to the negotiating table. But what it did do, of course, was to maintain the threat of invasion, a fear in Britain, which meant that Britain's priority was being able to defend the British island rather than being able to go out and do more in the Atlantic or do more in the Mediterranean or even to think about opening up some kind of front in Europe. And one of the other factors, of course, was to try and force Britain to keep as many resources as possible, aircraft, men, artillery, equipment, in Britain, rather than sending it to the Mediterranean, or, and this is quite an interesting concern of Hitler's really, from late 1940 onwards, intervening in the Balkans. One of the fears that Hitler has, of course, is that Britain will intervene in the Balkans, open up another front, and do so perhaps with some strength or indeed with some success. A fear which is exacerbated by Mussolini's decision to invade Greece. A decision taken, of course, without informing Hitler. So one of the arguments for bombing Britain is to make Britain keep as many of her resources as possible tied up in mainland Britain, and to make most of those resources increasingly defensive resources. Now that meant, for example, that by the end of the bombing, Britain had some 90 squadrons of frontline aircraft in Britain. An enormous number of high-quality fighter and night fighter aircraft, a huge amount of sophisticated radar equipment and more radar equipment being developed, huge numbers of anti-aircraft guns, and a very large commitment of scientific research and technical manpower to operating the air defense system. It also meant tying up 2 million people by the summer of 1941 in some form of civil defence activity. And that's a very large number of people. Many of them, of course, were volunteers, and some of them operated only part-time. But it nevertheless represented a very large call on British labour power And it is the sharp end of that Labour Party, doesn't it? Because all those people producing the fighter aircraft, the night fighters, the radar, and so on. And if we look at it that way, and it's the way, I have to say, that we generally look at the Allied bombing of Germany, when people try to argue that that was strategically significant, one of the things they always say is, well, look at what Germany had to keep in the Reich. All those fighter aircraft, all those repair squads, all those anti-aircraft guns. Nobody ever makes that calculation for Britain. And what I'm suggesting is, if you look at what Britain was forced to do during this period in keeping this material stuck in mainland Britain, it did achieve something of what Hitler wanted, which was to compel Britain to adopt a defensive stance and not to intervene more effectively in the Mediterranean or Europe. Did it affect the British economy? Well, on that, of course, the Germans were confident that by the end of the Blitz, after bombing British cities and ports continuously for 10 months, this must have had a serious effect on the British war economy. German intelligence suggested that British aircraft production was now down to 50% of what it had been in 1940. Goering was informed by a number of different intelligence reports, calculations, that something like one half of British armaments production had either been destroyed or delayed as a result of the bombing. In fact, that was the one part of a strategy which didn't work. British aircraft production was actually 50% higher by the end of the Blitz than it had been at the beginning. And calculations made later in the summer in Britain indicated that something like 5% of British production was actually lost as a result of German bombing over a 10-month period, a very small proportion, in fact, of Britain's productive economy. And it's interesting to note, of course, that exactly the same thing happened later on when the British and the Americans were trying to calculate what had been done to Germany. They too kept talking, we've knocked out half the aircraft industry. We've undermined a huge proportion of the German war economy. When in fact, for the first 2 or 3 years of that bombing campaign, they eliminated perhaps 7 to 10% of Germany's productive potential. But the critical thing was, as I've suggested, forcing Britain to keep very large resources in the mainland and inhibiting Britain's capacity to adopt a more flexible strategy and a more flexible choice of military operations. And it's interesting, I'd like to read a quotation from an intelligence assessment of the Blitz, which was produced in Germany a bit later on in the war, to show that this was more or less the judgment that the German leadership arrived at in the aftermath of the bombing offensive. In general, ran the report, the 10 months of uninterrupted attacks on the British Isles were of considerable importance in the subsequent unfolding of events. Even if this purely strategic air offensive did not force any decisions, the damage to enemy supplies and economy was nevertheless great. It was 2 years before the RAF was able to deal any effective counterblows. That's true, of course. Thus, the time when the Reich would have come under heavy attack had been delayed. Our flyers had assured that the Russian offensive would not be undermined from the rear. It's interesting to note that on the 28th of June, a few days after the start of the Barbarossa campaign, Joseph Goebbels wrote in his diary, the RAF, he said, has by and large not exploited the situation. Now, Britain, of course, saw the situation very differently. When the Blitz finished in June 1940-41, it was assumed this was only a temporary respite and that German bombing would begin again, probably begin again in about 3 or 4 months' time. Churchill was warned to expect, and I quote from the Ministry of Home Security, to expect worse attacks than we have yet known, as well as a persistent, threat of German invasion. Now, London, of course, knew about the impending German invasion, or Axis invasion, of the Soviet Union through ultra-intelligent sources as early as March and April, which was, in fact, the point at which the German air forces in northern France, Luftwaffe 3 and Luftwaffe 2, were also told about their imminent transfer to the east. And, of course, we know that London tried to warn Stalin, but the time and again, of course, Stalin's view really was that what the British wanted was to be let off the hook, not to be bombed anymore. Perhaps if they could drive some wedge between Hitler and Stalin, perhaps foment some kind of war in the east, then the bombing would stop and Londoners would be saved. And you can see, in a sense, I think, why Stalin imagined that in the context of 1941, with deep suspicions about the motives of Churchill and of British imperialism. Britain's only prospect of doing anything positive in the war at this stage, of course, was to launch a bombing campaign against Germany. Now, as I've already said, this is a campaign which began in May 1940, but it began in a very small way. It was a larger campaign by the spring of 1941. But the knowledge that Germany was about to invade the Soviet Union encouraged British leaders to think that they could carry out perhaps a joint bombing campaign with the Soviet Union. That if the Soviet Union bombed from one side and they bombed from the other, that might in fact have some kind of decisive effect on Germany's war effort. Churchill himself: a lot of German war industry should be vulnerable, especially if we are bombing from the other side. Now, of course, that was the only thing that Britain could do under the circumstances. In 1941, as we know, Stalin, of course, immediately after Barbarossa starts, asks Churchill, what can you do? Can you invade in France? Can you occupy the Germans in some way? Can you divert German resources from the contest in the east? But a second front of any scale was really impossible for Britain in the summer of 1941 and on into 1942 as well. Partly because of the diversion of enormous resources to defend Britain from the bombing, but partly because of, in Britain, the persistent fear of invasion, persistent fear of a renewed bombing campaign again in the autumn and winter of 1941-42. Now, we know, of course, that Churchill tried every means to placate Stalin by telling him, of course, that they were going to be bombing Germany. The British enormously exaggerated the effect of their bombing, partly, of course, to be able to persuade Stalin that they were doing something serious. And indeed, an air ministry spokesman later in the war, giving a speech about Britain's air strategy in the early stages, insisted that helping the Soviet Union had been a priority. And they quote, "The task then assigned to the air forces in 1941 was to give the utmost aid to Russia by striking at the war production of Germany. Not everyone," that includes people in Britain too, "not everyone has appreciated the extent to which the bomber offensive was applied to aid the Russian armies." Now, in fact, of course, when Germany invaded the Soviet Union on the 22nd of June, the RAF was incapable of doing anything very serious over German airspace. On the 22nd of June itself, some 70 aircraft bombed the city of Bremen. On the 23rd of June, 62 bombed Cologne, 41 bombed Dusseldorf. The heaviest raid that the British managed to mount in the whole of 1941 was a raid of 169 bombers against Berlin on the 7th and 8th of November. And that was actually the last time they bombed Berlin until the Battle for Berlin in 1943. The truth was, of course, that the RAF couldn't do very much to take the pressure off the Soviet armies in the summer and autumn of 1941. They persisted with the bombing only because of the political motives involved. And one of the things I want to argue, both in the British case, but also I think in the German case, which I've talked about already, of course, is just how important political factors were in making decisions about bombing strategy rather than other forms of military activity. And it's a view, I think, of bombing which has been sustained ever since 1945, the extraordinary capacity that bombing has to make political statements. Now, in the British case, there were a number of statements, of course, that they wanted to make. By bombing Germany, it was possible to show the United States that Britain was committed to the war and deserved lend-lease assistance. Second, of course, it was supposed to inspire occupied Europe. And actually, it's quite interesting, intelligence reports fed back from France, for example, in 1941 and 42, reflected enthusiasm among the French public for the bombing, even though it resulted in the death of French civilians, precisely because they did see that Britain was actually doing something to the Germans and not simply sitting there in its island. The third factor had nothing to do with the wider war at all. The third factor, of course, was that the bombing campaign from June 41 onwards was a way of satisfying radical political criticism in Britain, particularly from the British Communist Party, that Britain was not doing enough to help the Soviet Union. Indeed, by carrying out the bombing campaign, it was hoped that this would stifle domestic political criticism in Britain, and it would bring the radical left over to stronger support of Britain's war effort and of Churchill's leadership, which ended up, of course, with the extraordinary paradox after June 1941 of many people who had been anti-war, even pacifists in fact, increasingly coming round to argue that bombing German cities and killing German civilians was on the whole a politically acceptable thing. Now, it's important, I think, to recognise that both German and British strategy in the summer of 1941 was governed by the belief that Barbarossa would succeed in a matter of months. In Britain, most of the military and intelligence assessments gave the Soviet Union something between 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 3 months. This was true also, of course, in the United States. But it was true, of course, of Hitler and the German military leadership, which also believed that the Soviet Union could be knocked out in a 3 or 4 month campaign. And that once that had happened, of course, Germany was free to turn back to its strategy of bombing and invasion threat, which had been interrupted in June 1941. That might take place perhaps in the autumn or winter of 1941, Hitler thought Britain could probably be finished off after a renewed bombing campaign at some point in the spring or early summer of 1942. It's significant, of course, that this renewed offensive was also going to be employing for the first time Germany's true heavy bomber, the Heinkel HG-177, which it was hoped would come on stream in 1942. Goering planned a fleet of 600 heavy bombers, which would be capable of inflicting much heavier levels of damage on British industry and British society. It's also significant, as many of you will know, that in July 1941, a few weeks after the start of Barbarossa, Hitler ordered the famous armaments decree, which shifted the balance of armaments planning and production over the course of the next 9 months to the Navy and the Air Force and away from the Army. Priorities which reflected confidence that the Soviet Union would be defeated quickly and a belief that you had to increase the commitment to aircraft production and naval production in order to be able to complete the defeat of Britain and possibly the United States too in 1942. For Britain, of course, this belief that the Soviet Union would be defeated quickly and Germany would turn back again to complete the job it had, left in the spring of 1941 meant it was necessary to pour even more resources into anti-air defence of one kind or another. Throughout the autumn and winter of 1941-42, there was a continuous expansion, professionalisation, technical upgrading of all elements of British anti-air defence, from radar, night fighters, anti-aircraft artillery, and the Civil Defence Force. Britain's strategic profile during this period, and I think it's important to stress this, despite what was going on in the Mediterranean, which was small beer, of course, as we know, compared with what was happening on the Eastern Front, that Britain's strategic profile was essentially defensive during this period. There was little prospect even of a second front in 1942, not because of British timidity, not because Churchill preferred the Mediterranean, but simply because for too long Britain had been committed strategically and economically to large-scale defensive operations. It also meant, of course, that Britain had to focus on expanding the bombing of Germany, as that was the only thing to which they were already committed and the only thing they could effectively do during the course of 1941-1942. Not only that, but in the summer of 1941, the RAF decided that if they were going to do anything effective to help the Soviet Union, they would have to change the nature of their own bombing operations over German territory. It's often argued, of course, that Air Marshal Harris, when he was appointed Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command in February 1942, was the key figure in shifting to aerial bombing and a high level of civilian casualty. But in fact, the decision had been taken months before. And a great deal of research, technical and tactical research, was done, based largely on what the Germans had been doing to British cities, to try to see what would maximise the impact of what German, what British bombers could do in 1941 and 1942. And it was decided that trying to hit military targets or industry was hopeless. The targets were too small, you couldn't reach it, you might even find the town. The best thing to do would be to burn down the residential working class areas of German cities. And by doing that, you kept workers, you killed workers, you kept workers away from a large number of firms, and you undermined production across the city, rather than trying to hit one factory, missing it entirely, and having no effect on production whatsoever. So one of the consequences of the strategic profile that was adopted during the summer of 1941 was not only that Britain had to defend herself against the possibility of a renewed German bombing offensive, but that Britain go over to a particular kind of offensive against Germany, which eventually ended up, of course, destroying 50% of Germany's urban area and killing almost 500,000 people. Britain, of course, was saved by Soviet resistance. There never was a second Blitz. The invasion of Britain never happened. And Britain happily substituted bombing as its version of the Second Front. It's important, I think, to stress that in 1942, it was the United States Army which insisted on a ground offensive, a major ground offensive in Europe, which would lead to the physical destruction and occupation of Germany, of German forces and of Germany. It's possible to argue, though, I think, that German strategy was also distorted by the Blitz against Britain before Barbarossa. Barbarossa was, as I've said, seen largely as a pause. The bombing offensive and defeat of Britain would be renewed again after the defeat of the Soviet Union. Now, that doesn't mean that the invasion of the Soviet Union was not important, It doesn't mean that it didn't have ideological and economic imperatives, but it did, of course. The Soviet invasion of the Soviet Union meant defeating an ideological enemy, and it meant engrossing, of course, large resources. But nonetheless, if the Soviet Union had been defeated in 3 months, Germany would have turned back at some point in the next few months to the job of trying to defeat the United Kingdom. The problem was, of course, that the commitment in July 1941 to expanding air and navy armament left the army with something of a crisis when it became clear, in fact, that ground warfare was what was going to matter over the course of the next 9 months. It took a long time before that could be that could be changed around again. And by that time, of course, the Air Force itself was already committed to programs which could not be easily interrupted. The failure of Barbarossa, in fact, saw Germany caught in a strategic trap which Hitler had never really anticipated. By 1942, it was Germany's turn now to have to divert very large resources to the anti-air campaign in the German homeland. By 1943, as is well known, Germany was devoting 60% of its fighter aircraft to defending the Reich. A third of its ammunition output, a third of its electrotechnical output, a third of its radar output, radio output, etc., etc. In other words, Germany found itself, as a result of the failure to defeat the Soviet Union, trapped in exactly the same situation that they had placed Britain in during the German bombing offensive in 1940 and 1941. And what this did, of course, as it did in the British case, was to inhibit Germany's capacity to sustain effective offensive warfare in 1943 and 1944. But what I want to argue, and perhaps end on rather a teasing note, I think, is that if the Blitz had not happened, then perhaps the invasion of the Soviet Union in June 1941 might never have happened either. Thank you.